Hey folks, it's Smokescale Aquatus here with some more space news for you. It's going to be a little bit different this time. Instead of being the traditional format, since the show doesn't include its segments when it does a special and they went to BabsCon, I wanted to put together a bonus download that's a little bit longer, slightly different format. And to help me, I've got a friend here. If you are familiar with Fuzzy Logic, you might remember...
Mitch Kenzo.
Yep, he's with us. And so we're going to be discussing a few things. We're going to try to get through them pretty quickly. Going to glance over a few, but we're going to stick a little longer on some of them. So let's get right into it.
Go for it.
First off, we're talking about the ISS. There aren't any real firm plans to replace it right now. Recently, NASA and Roscosmos, the Russian space agency, had a press conference, both of them announcing that they would extend support for the ISS all the way to 2024. So we got 9 more years at least with it. Roscosmos expressed that they would be interested in the successor and making it a much wider, more international project, include more countries. NASA, on the other hand, said that they're hoping that the private sector would step in to fill the gap. How do you feel about that?
I don't know about the private sector. I mean, I like that the private sector is actually getting into it and doing more with space. I don't know that I like them just having control over a space station of their own.
Well, the idea would be they would build a private space station that would be leased by various governments to perform experiments or to bring private people up and what have you.
See, when you say leased by governments, that's what gets me worried.
Yeah. Well, to be fair, a lot of the different components of the ISS were built by private companies and then just launched by NASA or Roscosmos or various other organizations. I think the reason why NASA wants the private companies to build a low Earth orbit station is because they want to focus more on a mission to the moon, say building a base there, the asteroid redirect mission, and the mission to Mars. They want to focus on that and, you know, not worry so much about a station.
I'd like them to focus on that too.
I would too. I would very much like that too. Bigelow Aerospace is the only one I can find right now that's interested, and they're actually building an inflatable module that's going to go up and attach to the ISS to test the technology pretty soon. That's pretty cool.
Indeed.
Yeah. Not too long ago, back on March 16th, Cassini officially began a new series of orbits around Saturn. Originally, well, not originally, but recently, it had been orbiting in a polar orbit around Saturn to examine its poles. But the thing is, that doesn't give it a chance to really get a good look at Saturn's moons, except for Titan. So they had it readjust its orbit recently, and on its way, it got a real good look at Rhea, which is a sort of an icy moon. So they got some really good pictures of that.
Yeah, I never really hear much about Saturn's moons. It's always like Jupiter and anything near.
Yeah, it's...
Then again, we don't really know much about those moons out there.
Yeah, but what's really interesting is this... Cassini's been in orbit on mission at Saturn for almost 11 years, and it's given us so much really cool information, so many really great pictures of Saturn and its moons.
And it's impressive. How long was the mission supposed to run?
It says the expected end of life is 2017. At least that's what my notes say. But it's been able to find 62 individual moons, not counting the contents of the rings.
Saturn alone?
Saturn alone has 62 moons.
Move over Jupiter.
Jupiter has 67.
I retract my statement.
and Jupiter also has very thin rings. You just can't see them very well.
That's right.
Yeah. But it's this new orbit's going to give it the ability to make some really close passes to Titan at least 4 times. Forgive me if I'm saying this wrong. Dione, it's going to have 2 good passes. And Enceladus, it's going to get 3 passes. So we're going to get a lot of really great images, some really great scans of those moons. So I'm really interested
to see.
Can't
wait to see what they look like.
Yeah. So that I love hearing about what Cassini's doing. Everything about Cassini always fascinates
me. Cassini has always just been this little font of awesome, especially when we're at work just kind of looking up stuff.
Oh, yeah. The SLS maiden launch is set to be September 30th, 2018, but don't set your calendars just yet. It's far enough out, it can be wibbly-wobbly. But what's cool about this is it's going to have a secondary payload. It's going to have, in the staging adapter, that sort of conical section between the wider and skinnier sections, it's going to have 11 CubeSats that will be deployed by Spring System as opposed to pyrotechnics to protect the equipment. And they're all going to be for different things. They're all going to have different missions. They've already picked 3, and those 3, the first one is the Near-Earth Asteroid Scout, which is really cool. It's going to have a solar sail about the size of a bus.
You told me about this.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I think I could be mistaken about this. If anyone knows better than I do, I think this is the first vehicle we've deployed with a solar sail as its primary means of propulsion. If you know that this is wrong, if you know of another one before this, please let me know. It's going to go to... beyond low Earth orbit and have a look at various near-Earth asteroids to pick a candidate, or at least help us pick a candidate, for the the asteroid redirect mission. I think that's really cool.
I actually think a lot about that's cool. I think the deployment system that they're using for the CubeSats is just ingenious.
Oh, yeah. They described it as a jack-in-the-box system.
Mm-hmm. Well, which, in what really surprises me is you get all these really important, big, super-duper awesome things that NASA does, and then someone comes up, let's use a spring.
Yeah, yeah.
And it works.
Yeah. The next one is going to be called the Lunar Flashlight. And it's going to have a... Don't go there. Don't go there. I see your mind working.
No.
I see your mind working.
I remember this. That's what I'm saying.
Okay.
I'm not trying to ruin your podcast.
Anyway, it's going to have a solar sail, but it's not going to use it for propulsion. It's going to use it to reflect sunlight down into the craters that are almost always almost always darkened. And it's going to be looking for reflection off of water ice. So we can look for resources to make fuel, building materials, oxygen, water, things like that. So possibly scouting for a moon base site.
I keep hearing the word moon base lately. Yeah. It's making me happy.
Yeah, I really hope that we get to see a moon base within our lifetime. That would be amazing.
I hope so.
Yeah, the third one is called BioSentinel. And it's pretty simple. It's just going to go out into deep space and study the effects of deep space radiation on yeast for about 18 months. And this is really good because while yeast are very simple unicellular creatures, gives us insight into how we'll react to radiation.
Do humans react like yeast to radiation?
It'll give us an insight as to whether or not it would be as harmful as we think, whether or not our models are accurate.
Well, I'm thinking more along the lines of, is a yeast dead or not?
We've known yeast for a long time. We use them in a lot of stuff, so I'm not surprised that they're using that. Not only that, but they're very small and very lightweight, easy to move as a payload.
True enough.
And each CubeSat's going to be about the size of a large shoebox, and it's going to weigh about 30 pounds, and they're all going to be made from commercially available materials. They've been making CubeSats from smartphone components for a while now, so that's not going to be any difficulty. Any thoughts on that?
No, I mean, I'm impressed that our satellite technology is just getting this small. I mean, yeah. You look at those big old things you have on your poster in your room or hanging up off your ceiling, depending on who you are.
Yeah.
And now we've got, shoebox.
Yeah. Yeah, and what's really cool is they've said that every single SLS launch will have a secondary payload like this. They're looking to expand the usefulness of the SLS. So,
More power to
it. All right. Next up, JAXA's ordered a second run of the Plant Gravity Sensing Study, basically determining how plants sense which direction they're supposed to grow in the presence of gravity versus in the absence of gravity. And that's really cool because it deals with calcium.
Really?
Yeah. They find that as a plant grows, they have these calcium deposits that that they call gravity sensors, and that affects which direction the plant is supposed to grow.
That's interesting that a plant can actually use calcium like that.
Yeah. It's a very passive system, but that's what they've been studying.
I want to read more into that later because I want to know how a plant uses calcium to do that.
Yeah.
Like, what properties does it have?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I want everyone to be interested in this kind of thing.
I can't do that with my bones.
Yeah, but a couple of things that they're hoping to benefit by doing another study like this, agriculture. If they can figure this out, they found that plants that grow in zero gravity aren't able to resist gravity as well if they're put into gravity, if they get blown over, what have you. They're hoping that they can either breed or engineer plants that can resist high winds, storms, flooding a lot better, be able to stand right back up a lot more easily. And they're hoping to take the information they learned from this and apply it to learning how to treat osteoporosis, see how it progresses, that kind of thing.
Also, engineering plants in space, especially with those properties, it's going to be very useful if, say, we do need like a dome or something like that on the moon where we're growing things.
Oh yeah, it's going to make it real easy to start growing your plants in station as you're assembling your vehicle, then go to the moon and land and have everything ready to go, or have them growing on the way to Mars and have them ready to be transplanted on the Martian surface.
Oh my God, that'd be amazing. You just go to sleep and wake up tomatoes.
Yeah, basically. Basically. I'm really happy to hear that they're doing that. NASA has developed a new information system to share data that they recover from the ISS. They're calling it Physical Science Informatics. It's basically a repository that anyone can apply, any scientist can apply for access to, to perform whatever research they want from any discipline. And the goal for this is to try to share the results of the ISS as widely and as quickly as possible. Once you have access, you can actually set up reminders so that you can come back later and see, oh, the results for this experiment I've been waiting on are here. Let me just look that up and see what that is. This is really cool. They want to share all of this.
I'm sorry to sound sarcastic, but oh my God, sharing data in science?
Yeah.
Like, seriously, not actually being sarcastic, that is freaking amazing.
Yeah.
Because that is a lot of data.
Yeah, it's going to be sortable. They're going to have all sorts of features to make sure that the scientists can find exactly what they're looking for and cross-reference stuff. I want to see them do more with this. I want to see a version of, well, I'm going to see two other versions of it. One that's more geared towards high school students so that it can help them see what discipline they might want to go into if they decide they want to go into the hard sciences.
Mm-hmm.
And then another version that's for elementary students so that the teachers can get kids interested in science or at the very least the space program.
I want the latter because growing up, I really didn't have much of anything other than that's the sun.
Yeah.
It's warm.
Yeah.
Now, what I'd like to actually see them do is also if they have a bunch of data that they haven't exactly gone through or something like that, possibly set up something so that certain scientists can data mine that or something.
Oh, yeah. They've got this set up to data mine.
Just the raw stuff, yeah.
Yeah. Right now, it's just the higher pure research access, that kind of thing. So I want to see them do more with that. I hope they see the potential here because this is the vanguard to a whole new concept of data sharing in my mind.
I am happy to hear that.
Yeah, I am excited about that.
Please hear this podcast and make a classroom available.
I'd be happy to help you, you know, find a way to make it accessible to students, NASA, if you're listening, which you aren't probably. I wasn't too sure what this article was about from the article name alone. Pushing the boundaries for propelling deep space missions. Oh, it's going to be about ion thrusters. We already know about ion thrusters. That's nothing new. Then I dug a little deeper. They've developed a new ion thruster, the Hall thruster, which is three times as powerful as the standard models currently in use, and it's 50% more efficient. So not only can it provide you greater thrust, it can burn for longer.
Which we were actually just talking about this earlier today. That's mind-boggling because you don't have that happen in science very often.
Yeah, you don't take the same model and then make it better without making significant changes.
In two directions, in fact.
Yeah.
You make it more powerful while requiring less energy to make it more powerful.
Well,
not less
energy,
but
it loses efficiency.
Yeah.
But it's
so amazing.
For those of you who don't know how an ion thruster works, basically, you've got the reaction chamber, and they send a stream of propellant into it, usually xenon gas, which is very inert. It doesn't react much with anything. And they have basically a microwave, essentially, you know, a very high-tech microwave that excites electrons inside the reaction chamber, and this ionizes the gas, heats it up, and then it expels it out the back. This makes a very, very, very efficient engine. It's incredibly efficient, but it has very, very low thrust. The amount of thrust that the engines currently in use produce, it's about equivalent to just holding a piece of paper on your hand.
Yeah.
Doesn't sound like much, but once you're in the vacuum of space, and you burn for a long time.
Yeah. You can get just about anywhere you want, but it's gonna take you a while.
Yeah, it can build up tremendous amounts of acceleration over a really long burn. So I'm really happy to hear that they're making strides with that. I can't wait to see what other forms of propulsion they're developing.
Oh, God, yes.
Orbital ATK celebrates the 25th anniversary of the first Pegasus launch. The Pegasus is a solid-fuel rocket. It's three stages with an optional fourth stage that uses monopropellant that gets carried into the air by an airplane. It's a Lockheed L-1011. So it's a big, heavy plane, and it takes it up to a certain height, detaches, fires its engine, and it takes off. This is useful because rockets are usually very heavily dependent on weather, and by going up so high, they get above a lot of that weather so they can launch a lot more reliably. They don't have to scrub the launches because the window closed or because the weather was bad or what have you. But here's the thing. The rocket itself is called the Pegasus. The plane that carries it is called Stargazer. And Star Trek fans out there will recognize that the Stargazer was the ship that Captain Jean-Luc Picard was on board before Enterprise, and the Pegasus was a ship that Riker served aboard before he came to Enterprise as well. So that's why they named them that.
Well, no, you gotta be kidding me. Star Trek nerds in Latin and NASA? Nah.
Well, orbital ATK, but yeah.
Space.
Space. But it's flown 42 missions. Only three of them were total failures, and only two of them were partial failures. So 5 out of 42, that's not too bad. And they were all pretty early on in its life. So it's a pretty interesting rocket. It has a pretty small payload capacity, but launching from a plane, that's awesome.
Mm-hmm. Also, it's a freaking rocket.
Yeah, it's rockets are awesome, man. But before we go, I wanted to give you guys something that I haven't been able to do because it's not really a long format segment. This is definitely different from before. I want to give you a list of upcoming launches. You can always go to spaceflightnow.com and check out their launch manifest, or you can just Google launch manifest and it'll be one of the first links. And you can see all the launches that are scheduled on the docket, no matter where they're being launched from, who's launching them, what's being launched. It runs the gambit and it updates pretty regularly. So with the understanding that these dates are subject to change, here are the upcoming launches. April 13th, that's going to be this coming Monday, Falcon 9 is going to be launching the CRS-6. That's the commercial resupply mission. It's going to be SpaceX's Dragon. It's going to be launching from Cape Canaveral, Space Launch Complex 40, which is the historic launch site. The launch window is going to be 3:33 p.m. Central Daylight Time. It's going to be an instantaneous window, meaning it has to launch the instant it turns 3:33. There is no expanded window because hitting the ISS is kind of a difficult target, so they have to get it right on the money. After that, we have April 15th, I'm sure I'm mispronouncing this, the Arani 4 carrying Thor 7 and Sikral 2. Again, I'm not sure how to pronounce these.
Words.
Yeah. The launch window is going to be 2:43 p.m. to 4:37 p.m. Central Daylight Time, and it's launching from French Guiana. I don't know too much about these satellites, but you can always go look them up. It's easy to find this information. April 24th, we have a Falcon 9 launching, carrying the Turkmen Elman 25E and MonacoSat. They don't have a launch window yet. It's still to be determined, and it's going to be launching from Canaveral, Space Launch Complex 40. April 29th, the Russian Proton is going to be launching the MexSat-1. It's going to be a Mexican satellite. Launch window, again, to be determined. Yeah, it's pretty cool. They're getting their own satellite network.
Nice.
Yeah,
about
yeah.
Same time.
It's going to be launching from Baikonur Cosmodrome in Kazakhstan. I love saying that, Baikonur. It's just fun to say.
I'm sure
I'm actually mispronouncing. I'm sure it's Baikonur. But it's just a fun name to say. It's awesome. And then we have April 28th, the Soyuz Progress 59P, which is another resupply mission to the ISS. That's going to launch from Baikonur as well. It's going to launch at 2:09 p.m. Central Daylight Time. And then we have on May 6th, the Atlas V is going to be carrying the AF-SPC-5 from SLC-41 in Canaveral. The window is going to be 8 a.m. to 12 noon Central Daylight Time. What's really interesting about this, the AF-SPC is actually a secret Air Force vehicle. It's a little space plane, an unmanned space plane.
Ooh.
Yeah, within the last 6 months, I think, it returned to Earth from a mission that was in space for over a year.
Yeah, I remember you mentioning that, and nobody knew about it.
Yeah, no one knows what it was up there doing. No one knows what its primary mission was, but it was up there for over a year. That's all we've got this time. You can always find out what the other launches are all about. Those are pretty much the only ones I had actual hard dates for. Beyond that, it's a little far out to really solidify with any reasonable reliability, so I kind of stuck to just those.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
Weather is great stuff.
Well, not just that, but something wrong with the tracking system, something wrong with the rocket, something wrong with the payload, all kinds of things. Hundreds of thousands of things can go wrong.
Literally.
Just seeing a rocket go up at all is kind of a minor miracle.
Yeah, at least at our current technology level.
Yeah, we're getting better at it. We're getting better at it. But it's getting busier as far as rocket launches are concerned.
Good, it
needs to. Yeah, we're seeing more and more go up every year. So I'm excited. So the future is bright.
Future has rockets in it.
Yep. The dream is alive.
Yay!
So that's pretty much all we've got for you this time. I'd like to thank Mitch for helping me out with this. I wanted to make it sound more conversational, and he certainly helped with that.
No, I didn't.
Yeah. That's just how he is. But I've been wanting to experiment with this form of a show before. I just didn't have a real good excuse for it. So tell me what you think. If you like this version, let me know. If you prefer the more traditional format, let me know. And if you want to learn more about the stuff that we talked about, you can follow NASA, Roscosmos, Orbital ATK, all these other organizations on Twitter, Facebook, various other social media. And until then, this is Smokescale Aquatus.
Mitch Genzo.
Saying, keep looking up, space fans.